November 2nd, 1978, tape 2, side 1. I'm Robert McCandless, and I'm talking to Johnny Taku Jack. Johnny, could you tell something about the years that you spent working for George Ball and the other men in the big game hunting in and out of Telegraph Creek? Could you tell something about the kind of people who came hunting and where they came from?
Oh, yeah. First of all, when I went to Telegraph Creek when I got married in 1932. But before I went to Telegraph Creek, how I learned to be a cook was when the mail run between Atlin and Cacross, there's two different roadhouses there. One was the place they called the Pigtail Point. It was right across from Indian River. And that's where I used to look after the roadhouse, and then that's where I learned to cook. So when I moved to Telegraph Creek, I didn't have any other kind of job to do or nothing at all. The people over there, they just want to have their own their people to do the work. But one of the native guy over there, he became to be a friend of mine. His name was Yeho Brown. And he told his people, he says, "That man came in this country here to live amongst us," he said. "We should treat him like our own brother. Because," he said, "what will he say if he go back to his hometown and tell the people that Telegraph Creek people is no good at all? They wouldn't give me a job." He said, "Why don't you fellas give him a job, try him out?" So the first thing I did was, when I went out with a hunting party, it was the DuPont lady. She was and her husband.
That was the first one you went out?
That's the first one I went out with. At that time, back in Atlin, we used to pack in horses with the sawbucks, they called the pack saddles. But when I come to Telegraph Creek, I was a horse wrangler the first trip out, and happened to be with that Mexican outfit they were using, that apparels they call. It's a big stuff where they put hay inside, and you have to fold it apart to keep it smooth. Otherwise, every one day that thing, the hay inside the apparels, it bunched up and put a bunch on the horse back there, and all this awful thing. When you put it on a horse, you have to pull it up, and it's just like corset, it's scissor hole on the horse back. Mm-hmm. And you got to know how to pack on that. So I thought to myself, I think the packs were too high, and that's the reason it go one way or the other, even if it's the same weight as one another. So I do my own packing like the way I used to pack in Atlin for those shorts on a saddle. So the first season I went out, it was for George Ball. That was the DuPont lady. And I had an awful time for the first 2 days with the packing. But when I take my own way to packing, I had to even balance on the pack. And by golly, I done well. That was the first trip out. And this DuPont lady, I think it was from Los Angeles she came. Oh, they was very nice, her and her husband. They wasn't taking no antlers. They wasn't taking no trophies out. It was just a picture, mm-hmm. Picture man. I don't know, Tom Carlick, that died lately, he was the guide for the lady. DuPont lady, and his brother, oldest brother, his name was Ludwig or Carlick. He was the head guide, and he was the guide for the man. And at that time, Jonathan Coots Carlick, who is alive yet today, he's in Terry's, he was the cook, he was a very good cook too. And I was the packer, but old man Ludwig or Carlick is the one that showed me how to pack on the apparels. And he helped me too, which is not his job, he's a head guide. But to see me get along, so he showed me. And so Jonathan Chris Carlick and I moved the pack moved a pack train and a camp. Every time we moved from one camp to another, someplace we stay 2 days. And I stay in the camp and do nothing. And so the ladies thought that I should come along with them, so I did. I come along with them, and I was a packer, and she's taking moving picture cameras. And when we go halfway at a day off, then she want to go back and look for around to take some pictures. She took gophers pictures. She took anything that we see, she took the picture of it. And finally, that's the reason I always don't stay one place if I go from people around and get me embarrassed. Anyway, so I go with them, and when I go back and take her back, and Mr. Kenny, her husband, always tell me, be sure and get home now, we don't get lost. They're just joking away. But I take her, and sometimes I see, twice I see a caribou, and I take her over, and she took the picture of that. And sometimes we see, one time we see a porcupine, and she come right up to it, and she took a picture of that. Govers and the flowers and all that thing. Oh, they was very nice. And the cook and the guides and all of them treated the hunters very, very good. And they respect them too. They don't use any cruel language in front of the hunters, even the hunter himself, a man. So that was the first year I was there. And the second year, I went to work, and I went for George Ball, and I was on the mow machine, which I know something about it, because that's the first thing I learned in Athens, to use the mow machine and the hay rack and baling hay. So I went on working on a ranch. Before George Ball owned the ranch, it was Diamond C ranch. But when George Ball had it, they call him Diamond B Ranch. I go down there and put up the hay, cut the hay for them. And then in the fall time, I went out, the second hunters, I went out with this H.E. Millard. He's, what do you call that, calcium mine. He's got a calcium mine. And he calls it Sweet Arrow. I don't know, it was from the States someplace. He said the reason he called it Sweet Arrow, that's where the Cree Indian or some of the Indian, I forgot now how it went. He fired arrow across the river canyon, and the arrow went right across with a bow and arrow, shoot it across. And when he get that arrow back, he kissed it and he said, Sweet Arrow. And that's where H.E. Millard called his outfit, calcium mine outfit, they call it Sweet Arrow. He's an older man, and he went out hunting for 30 days. And I went out cooking for him. Pat McCluskey was the head guide, and Tommy Hawkins was the packer, and I was the cook. And we tried it, we treat the old fella as good as we can. And he done the hunting, but the rifle he's got was no good, so the guides had to use my 30-30 rifle, and the boys had to do the hunting and get the game for him. But on the record it says that day he killed this one and that day he killed that one. And the only thing that I remember he killed was a grizzly bear. They saw that there was a snowfall about 4 inches deep, and they saw a grizzly bear tracks. And Pat McCluskey told him, he said, now is the time we can get our grizzly, he said. So they tell us, Tommy Hawkins and I, they tell us where to put up the camp, and they're going to go after that grizzly bear. So the guide told him, he says, it's better not to go after the grizzly bear tonight, it's too late. but tomorrow we'll track it. We're going to find them. So they did. They come home and they went out. Instead of that, they make a loop around. They got the moose. They got the moose head all right. The guide had to get the moose for him, but it was on the record. It was him. He got that. So they bring that home, and the next day they went after the grizzly bear. So up, I said, that's what it is up in the mountains. There's a buck. There's a scrubby balsam, and it's thick. The grizzly bear went into it, and then he went out the other side, and he went to the other scrubby brush. It's high. The guide says that the grizzly bear want to go to bed now. He said, don't make noise. He said. So when they get to there, Pat told him, he says, oh, he get off the saddle. He said, you wait here. And have your rifle handy. If I go around the other way, if I scare him out, he might run out this way. So he went around the other way, and the wind was blowing from where he went to the scrubby brush. And just when he got there, the grizzly bear got the wind. He backtracked himself, and here old man Mr. Millard was standing there with a rifle. He didn't even point it. He just hollered, here it is, bang, away, and he just shot him right dead. And he was lucky. Across the front paw, it's exactly 8 inches across the front paw, and the claws is exactly 3 inches long, and the whole thing is 14 feet long, the height, and that's the biggest grizzly bear I have ever seen in my life. That was the biggest. And that was the end of the hunting that time for with Mr. H.E. Millard. And then later on, the following year again, I went out with another party. It's Kennedy's name was. And he'd been hunting in Alaska, in Juneau, Alaska. It's a native guy. He's half-breed. But he's got the Indian name too. His name was Johnny, oh, I forgot the last name. But anyway, he took this closing outfit, man from Los Angeles. His name was Kenneth. And I went out hunting with cooking for this guy. We went up to the East Coast area. And before we get to the trip, I went up 40 mile, they call the place, before we get to the East Coast. From lifting a heavy pack, I pulled some mud and my nose started bleeding, and I got hemorrhage. And I stayed there, and they had to get Dalzell to throw me out of there. And then I went to Wrangell, Alaska, and the doctor was there. They had to get me, I had to get blood transfusion from that, and then they cauterized it. And I went back, and I never get a nosebleed ever since. And when the whole trip is over, George Ball didn't want to pay me for the trip because I got a nosebleed halfway up. But Mr. Kennedy, the close manufacturer man, that he didn't like the idea. So he called me, and everybody got $25 tip, all of them. Well, I got $100 tip from Mr. Kennedy, and he gave me an envelope, and I got my fully paid for the 40 days trip. All done all on his own, and that's what you call a very nice gentleman. Mm-hmm. I was the cook, and they appreciate what I cook for them. I even cook a porcupine meat for them, and they thought that was a great meat to ever taste, a wild animal. I lost that trip going out with them, but I got full paid for 40 days on that trip. And then the following year again, as usual, I went out down to Balls Ranch, and I done some putting up hay, and after I finished. And I don't know, the hunters put in such a good word for me. They always isolate me for married hunters that's coming in. And I always always go for the married with the married hunters. Some of the cooks, they got kind of didn't like that. They tried to put in some little rumors about me to the guide outfitter that I've done something this to the grocers and this to the give some away and all that stuff. Every one of them does the same thing. When the kids come around, you go to some camp, you got to give them something sweet and stuff like that. And some places, sure, I give meat away, a little grub away, because we got no canned meat. And if they had any meat, well, or a fish, I give them a little trade off. That's how I give the thing away. I don't give it away for nothing. But then I went out with a fella, I forgot his name now, this one here, but I got it in Cassia in my notebook. He's a doctor. He's a very nice fella. Him and I went out hunting again. Then we went into the, what you call, a Cassia, Chesley area, and then we went right up to the Level Mountain area. He was a doctor. And Tommy Senior, Tommy Dennis is the guide for with us, and Benny Frank was a horse wrangler. Oh, we had a very good trip. He's from Los Angeles. He's got sugar diabetes. And the fella never gets sick all the way through that trip. And I knew what to do, how to cook for the guys with the sugar diabetes. I don't cook everything that's sugar in it, the same thing over and over. Mm-hmm. First I go to one sample and I want a label, and then another one, another one. On the fifth day at the end of the week, then I go back to the first one again. And I never did have trouble with the hunters. They never mm-hmm. took sick on me. So when that fellow went out, he gave me a very good tip, because he was very happy that he completed the trip without getting sick. And then the following year, I went out with another party again. That was Edward Kerr. And his wife was a Jewish woman, and she don't like the wild meat. We had two pack horses, just the stuff he's supposed to eat. And when I was cooking there for the hunters, and I was cooking for two outfit. Mm-hmm. And before we finished the trip, that was the late John Craig was the hunter, the big hunters for at that time. And that was John Craig's party. And his brother's name was Andy Troxell. But the right way, his name was Andy Dennis. And his brother Alec, his name was Alec Dennis. And at that time, we got Alec Dennis and Bell Noel was the packer at that time. And we complete the trip. At the end of that trip, that Edward Kerr was, his wife started eating the wild meat, because she said, I don't know what I was missing. She said, when she get there, she eat the wild meat. She even took the recipe from me, how I cooked curry and rice. He said, back home in where she come from, he said, they burned the curry until it get brown. And then they used that. And she told me the way it is, the way I cooked it, is they wanted to know, so I showed it to her. And she took a, she put it down on her notebook.
When you were cooking, did you ever use any of anything, like you were cooking wild meat, but did you ever use any of sort of like spices or anything from where you were? Did you ever use any sage or wild onions or any of those?
Oh yes, we used some things. But the hunters, I asked the hunters what the sort of stuff that goes into the anything I cook, Dave, not to be afraid to tell me, because if you don't like that stuff, he could tell me I don't use them things, and then I cook the other way for them. But it generally, from the way we cook in the country area where we are, they're always satisfied with that kind of a cooking.
Mm-hmm.
always. The best part of the cooking that they like, the hunters is bannock. Cooking by the frying cook, the frying pan, and the way we cook bannocks, and we tell them that's how we eat all the time when we are trapping and stuff like that. They like that. Oh, baking powder biscuits. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing they're digging for when they come home. All that sort of stuff. And the stew. They said that the best way to cook the best stews they ever had, it's a stew, wild meat. But we got a way to cook them things. That's our own style ourselves. We done that. We do that. We chop up the stew in a small pieces like any other stew. Then we'll put it in a frying pan or in a Dutch oven. Then we'll put grease in it and then we fry it up. It's got to be halfway fried up all the way through. And then we cover it up with the lid. And then the steam mixes a lot of water in it. Then we put the curry or something, whatever we want to put in, or rice, curry and rice. And that's how we always cooked our stew. Yet today we do the same, and the hunters really like that kind of cooking. Same thing happened in Cassia area. Mrs. Frank Stewart had a tick recipe out of how to cook stew, the way we cook stew, from a fellow named Joe Carlick. He's a little fellow I saw him in town here the other day. He learned everything by experience, and by golly, he's a very good little cook. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that time I was finished with Edward Kerr, I had a very good tip from him, a very good one. And then the following year, I went out with another party again. That was J.W. Fisher. He's the Fisher bodybuilder. He come from Los Angeles. And he's a cranky one because I don't blame him. He's got a very bad sugar diabetes. And I went out cooking for him. And to my surprise, he treated the cook very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. He was his right-hand man, the cook. And his wife, they were very good. But he's not taking any trophy out. He was just taking pictures. He's got a cameraman, the man that carried packed the camera around with him, and he's got a guide for his wife, and he's got a guide for himself. And when they don't get anything, he bawl everybody out, or he give everybody an awful languages sometimes. Well, I don't blame the fella because you expect he's liable to take sick any time and go back, but. Finally, he left his wife home, and one mistake I did, and I took her out after everything fixed up in the kitchen, and I took him to Black Bear. We saw Black Bear, and I took her over. She took 150 feet of that. Oh, she sticked one place, she got one of those zooming camera, and we was quite away from it, and he was taking the picture of that. And that spoiled it for the other guides, and I was very sorry for that. But anyhow, there was a lot of game around. I don't know why they don't get the pictures for the other guy, for Mr. Fisher. And at the same time, the cameraman don't exactly know what to do with the camera. When he's ready to shoot and to see the game hunting, when he looked back, the camera was still packed around and the man standing there with it. That didn't go very good for the hunters. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, finally, everything changed around. Tom Carlick had to stay with the lady because that's his hunter. And we got horse wrangler and we got the cameraman. So the cameraman can do the cooking, so I show him what to do. And I go with the lady there to, I go with Mr. Fisher for a cameraman. I know how to handle them things. I done it before. And by golly, he got his pictures and he's got everything he wants in there. Mm-hmm. So when we get back, Going back, one of the boys told him that two more days before we get back to Telegraphic, one of the boys tell him, he says, everybody else getting boiling out, Mr. Fisher. He says, how come the cook never get boiled out? He started laughing. He's got a cigar in his pocket all the time. He don't smoke it, but he chew it like tobacco. He took the cigar out and took a big chew at it and sit there. It's a long story behind that. He said, and I'm going to tell you guys why they could never get bawling out. He said, I went to India, he says, to Africa, he says, hunting. And the cook, when I come home, I give hell. He says, I'll bawl the cook out. And you know what happened? He said, when I went out, by golly, I eat hardtack, them round stuff. I eat hardtack for 40 days, he said. And I says to myself, if I bawl him out again, I'm not going to get anything but I'm going to eat now. He says, I'm going to get, it's going to be bad. So I had to be very good. And I was all the way stay. He hold that grudge against me for 40 days. I had to eat hardtack all the way through for bread instead. So he said, that's the reason, he says, I won't bawl out no cook at all. Now he said, this is the best trip I ever had out. He said, this man I'm cooking for, I never get sick on nothing, he said. He knew what to do, because George Ball told me, he said, that this man cooked for a man with sugar diabetes, and I'm pretty sure you won't have trouble with this cook. That's why he says, cook is my man, he said, he'll never get a fall of God. And I got $300 tip. He said the reason why he gave me $300 tip, because he never took sick and he enjoyed the whole trip. That was Mr. Fisher. Then, of course, I went out with the other parties, and some of them I get $50 tip. I don't have to talk about some of them. They get pretty nasty sometimes for no reason. Then finally the hunters was all over. Then I started working down to the Prince Rupert to work for Nelson Brothers and the reduction plant as a carpenter. And that's where I learned my carpenter trade. I go into 3 o'clock coffee time. I go into his the office there, and then they take me to the table. They teach me about the blueprints, and they teach me all the other stuff. So as far as when I learned that thing, I learned to be a carpenter from rough to fine finishing, fine finisher, fine work. And so it's the laying the cement from rough to fine. And I can read the blueprint. So I went up north. When I came here to north, the first thing I did, I asked for a job, and I couldn't find any job. I got my carpenter tools with me. I came to Whitehorse. I heard about this federal building, the building in here. I thought I could squeeze in somehow to get a job in there. But a lot of the Indian fellas told me that's impossible. You can't get a job there. Everybody's tried. So when I come to the construction man over there, his name was Dutchy. I went into his office and he looked at me. He looked kind of rough guy to treat with, to deal with. He told me, what can I do for you? Well, I said, mister, I said, my name is John and Jack. Oh, yes, my name is Dutchy. Shook hands with me. What is up? What can I do for you? Mister, I said, I came all the way from Telegraphic over here to look for a job. I says, and I got my carpenter tools and I'm looking for a job to do some carpenter work. And he said, you got your tools? I said, yes, it's in Atlin. I said, but I'm coming over. Where did you learn to be a carpenter? I said, Prince Rupert for Nelson Brothers. He said, that's where I learned it. He says, get your tools and go to work Monday. So I got 3 days left and I went to Atlin and get my tools. Before I went, I told him that my son, Peter Jack, is a laborer. He's looking for a job too. So he asked the labor foreman that, so they took him to it. I worked in the fall in here for the building, and till late in the fall. I got laid off that job, and that was the end of it. And I moved back to Atlin. And the following year, I went to work for the Department of Highways. At that time, that
How did you go from Telegraph Creek to Prince Rupert? Did you know some people in Prince Rupert?
No. The Indian Affairs Branch is the one that sent the boys down there. Mm-hmm. And when we get to down there, there's no leader for the Indian boys from Telegraph Creek. Mm-hmm. So they got a bunkhouse there for the Telegraph Creek boys. They call them the Telegraph Bunkhouse. And when they all join up the Fisherman Union and the Allied Shore Workers Union, that's mm-hmm. what I was. And they asked the boys that they got to nominate somebody for a shop steward. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Coots Carlick, he was down there too with a bunch working. So they appoint me for a shop steward for the Telegraph Boys.
Oh, I see. And so the Telegraph Boys, they were working in the cannery there too then?
Yeah, there's 35 boys go, 36 including me. Hmm. So at the end of the season, I was the head man for the Telegraph Boys in the bunkhouse, and I didn't know I was getting 20 cents an hour for that back pay. From since I went to work till I come back to Telegraph Creek, I got 20 cents an hour back pay on that. And the following year, I get a telegram again from the outfit, and the Nelson brothers, they tell me to pick up 35 boys and send them the list down there. And from the day I get the telegram, I get my wages started until I go back down to Prince Rupert.
November 3rd, 1978, with Johnny Taku Jack, tape 2, side 2. Now, Johnny, you were talking about the boys going to Prince Rupert to work in the cannery. Was this just after the war then?
Yeah, it was just, that was in the, that was about 38 or somewhere, 48.
48.
After the war, yeah.
That they went down, yeah.
Yeah, everything. Well, the fur price was not very good at all, and everybody had an awful tough times around. And, of course, the only way that they had to keep things at that time was that some of the people used to put up a dry salmon and stuff like that and sell that thing for, sell the fish for trade of grub to the Hudson Bay and all that sort of stuff. And finally, Jonathan Coots Carlick is the guy that got after the Indian department. If you can't help any Indians nowhere in the reserve, why don't you try to get a job for them someplace? Mm-hmm. So the Indian Affairs Branch went in contact and Prince Rupert, the Nelson brothers, they got the cannery in there and the reduction plant. So since they was kind of short of fishermen, all the people that used to do the work around in there, they know how to fish. And so they make up that the Indians' voice come Telegraph Creek will be just the kind of man to be working in a cannery in reduction plant, because the people in the coast there, they know how to do the fishing, and the law says at that time that you have to be 3 years in the coast before you could do any fishing. Mm-hmm. You have to learn that. So that's how the Telegraph Boys go to Prince Rupert from Telegraph Creek. And the first year we went down there, I got the job to look after the boys, to tell them what to do in a bunkhouse. And I was getting 20 cents an hour over back pay for that. So the following year, again, they sent the telegraph boys, done pretty well, working for Nelson Brothers. And I do the job repair work under the reduction plant, and sometimes I have to go in a cannery to do some repair works in there. I was the head man for six helpers I got, and I was getting a carpenter foreman's pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other boys, they work in the cannery. Sometimes when the fish is not coming in, sometimes the boys, 2 or 3 days, they don't do any work. But sometimes a big bunch of fish come in, then all the boys have to go to work in the cannery. So that kept up for the last trip I had. Down to Prince Rupert was 1952, spring of 1952. That was the last trip I make down to Prince Rupert. And at that time, they were going to dam up Atlin Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreman, carpenter foreman of mine, told me, you prove yourself that you can take small contracts out for yourself and you can make very good money on that. If I were you, he says, I'd go to Atlin, he says, because they're going to dam up the place, you can take any kind of job, like, say, for instance, like cement work and stuff like that, and contracts. So that's why I quit and I moved.
Mm-hmm.
I moved to Atlin. Instead of that, they closed up the dam. They didn't do any more about it. But I happened to get a job from the Department of Highway, and I stayed with it for 9 years.
Which dam was that going to be? Do you remember what they were going to do?
Well, that dam, it was either going to run to Skagway, and then they says there was about 12 mile tunnel,
yeah,
from south end of Atlin Lake running into the Nakina to Taku River.
Mm-hmm.
That's the proposed.
Yeah.
And the Atlinto, that running into Tagish, was supposed to be dammed up in there, so the water run the other way towards the Taku River. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know what turned up, and that was canceled. And now I heard that there's going to be a temporary dam in there at Linto to hold the water. So I don't know what the people thinks about that.
Yeah, I knew there'd been talk about that. So the government went along with that, the idea of sending the boys down to Prince Rupert, because they couldn't go trapping.
They can't go trapping. The fur price is so low and there's no work.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the odd hunters come to telegraph cricket, not like before.
Not as many.
No.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that used to uphold the Telegraph Creek was the pack train used to pack under the Dominion Government Telegraph Line north to Paddy's Lake and then south to the Echo Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And since the Telegraph Line closed up, I forget what year it was, there's no more pack. There's no more pack train work.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since the road went through to Dees Lake and the river boats around in there, that cuts off the pack train to Dees Lake again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only thing that was left now was the hunting outfit. And it have to be experienced guys that go with the hunters. And the other stranger guys, you have to teach them all over again. to go with the hunters. So later on, the hunters get slacking up, and finally the Hudson Bay Company had to close the hunting outfit. They don't outfit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the only outfit that was there now was George Ball. And when George Ball died, the place closed up.
What year did he die?
I forget what year it was. The place closed up, and just lately, his son, Bobby Ball, that opened it up again. It mostly like a dude ranch now, just trail ridings and stuff like that. The odd hunters come up there. And it's a very poor hunting area. That's
at Dees Lake area.
Down at George Ball's, Bobby Ball's area.
Oh, I see.
But up to the Dees Lake area, then that's where the best part of the hunting areas are now. And another one towards that Stewart Road, where Bruce Craig got a outfit. That's where John Craig used to own the area. That's a good area too. But it's kind of spoiled now because they got a, what do you call that, park.
Mm-hmm.
They got a game park in there, and nobody can hunt in there. That's the best part of the place where they have the park.
Oh, I see.
But I think it's okay because that's the breeding area. That's where the sheep and the goats and stuff like that, they breed. And then there's another one at the Coldfish Lake. And that party that running the Coldfish Lake is not as good as Tommy Walker. Tommy Walker was doing pretty good over there. But the new man took over, he's changed the way around. And some of the people that want to go out there and do some guiding for them.
Mm-hmm. This park you mentioned, is this somewhere between Telegraph Creek and Atlin?
No, that's between Stewart and Don Tenny John.
Oh, I see. Eton Tenajon, I'd heard that word before. What does it mean?
Well, a long time ago, there's a little kid. He went in the water as it sloops down. That's when the kid can't turn around and come back. He kept on going until he got drowned. And that's what they call Adon means kid. Adon. Tenajon means he's gone, he went in the water. So that's what the meaning. Baby went in the water.
Hmm.
Kid went in the water, that's right. Adon Tenajon. Kid went in the water.
Yeah, I'd heard that name. So after you had so many jobs, you were at Prince Rupert, and you went from there, and you went to Atlin, and you worked for the highways for a while, and then you went to Cassiar?
Mm-hmm. That's where I end up.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I'll just stop for a minute. Johnny, if we could just go back to trapping again to finish off this tape. Could you explain something about when a trapper gets started trapping, about how he decides about how many traps he's going to use and where he puts his traps and how often he visits them? Like, there's a lot of choices that a trapper can make about when he's working an area.
Well, The trapping is just like anything else. You'll have to practice at it, which way you can make money. And you have to figure things, how many traps you're going to set. If you set a bunch of traps, you're losing that many days to take care of the other traps you have set. So, for my part, that's the way I used to trap myself. 50 traps was good enough for the winter. That's including from number odd trap up to number four. And I never use anything more than that. At 50 traps, it can keep you very busy. The best I have ever trapped is every 3 days I run the traps. Anything beyond 3 days, it might cut his paw off, and you lose it. Or something else will come around, such thing as a wolf will kill it and tear up the hide, and you lose that much fur. But by using the 50 traps or even 60, you got lots of work to do on that. I have heard that before, that some people had 200 traps set out, and at the end, sometimes through the winter, he lose 10 skins. Something would get away with it and damage it and stuff like that. Well, when we are trapping, we got to trap what we trap, we're always happy to get it before we lose it. And the only thing that I know that don't fight at all, I have pity on them too, it's a link. You could even trap just with it, even one toe, one little claw would be hanging on, the trap would hang on it, he'd sit there. And what we call the link, when we catch them, such an animal that we kind of hate to kill whenever we catch one, because it's not fussy, it's not fighting, it's just to sit there and growl at you. That's the reason long time ago, old Indians, they used to have a stick, long stick and a snare at the end. And when you put it over his head and you pull that, and they pull the other one, you strand him right away. And we never use club on them. And they never use 22 on it too, because your blood go all over the fur. So they use snare, us Indians, but the white people, they use 22. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing, any other kind of fur, you're going to lose it if you don't run it the right time. That's how a lot of us Indians find out that if we use around 50, 60 traps, even 40, we do just as much trapping as we did with 200 traps, because we don't lose any. But for beaver trapping, I do believe the more traps you put out, the more you're going to get. Sometimes, when I was in the Taku River, we set traps for about 40 miles in the Taku River. I'd put in about 50 traps, and that keep you busy, and my partner will, about the same. I know we set out 150 traps, but we done that all in boat. Mm-hmm. And there is a sinkers on the traps. When you catch a beaver, when he jump over into deep water, he can't come back up and drown it. You drown them. And it's a guaranteed get every beaver you get, even if you get them in a claw, it's drowned. And we don't lose it. So mm-hmm. the more traps you put out for beaver in the springtime, you can expect more fur because you don't lose them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the dry fur animal. That's the only way the Indians used to trap. Even the white people do that. But I don't know how true it is. They say the government don't allow to sink a beaver. That's cruel. Well, I do believe it's cruel, though, if you suffer a beaver with a trap on his hand and stay alive for 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing. If you shoot a beaver in the head while it's in a trap, they say you can get pinched for that because they don't allow to use rifle on the beavers. So if it's a live beaver, we have to use club on them, and I think that's cruel.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the law, we have to follow it. Some of the traps, like marten traps, we can guarantee we're not going to lose any unless there's a wolverine come around and pick up the marten skins. We set the traps on a trees, half a lean pole leaning on a tree, and set the trap on that pole. And when he gets caught, it falls over, it jumps over, and the trap hangs down, and the marten hangs there, and it froze in the wintertime there. And we guarantee we're not losing it.
Mm-hmm.
Not only us people, the white men and all do the same thing. But the Indians do believe in using deadfall. We use deadfall, and it's a sure kill. Just as soon as we get them, when the trap offset, bang, it go, and that's the end of the marten. Even wolverine, even wolf, we use wolf, them kind of traps, right? And if there's any wolverine around where there's trapping marten, the best thing we do is to set out 2 or 3 different deadfall out for the wolverine. We have to get rid of him because he's going to take the marten from the trap. And what he took the marten for, we don't know. Because if you follow a wolverine, they take a marten from a trap. Pretty soon you see round tramping on the snow. Round, 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 and then it go from there again. But we took the walking stick we had, we poke around where he go round. If we don't find anything there, we keep following him and finally go round again someplace. And I guess he make up his mind, he says that's no, it's not the place, it go again. And the last one he'd come to, when he go around like that and it looks like he tramped the snow down, then he'd go from there, off he went, just go straight. We poke around and then by God we find the marten right there. What he take it for, we don't know.
So they take it out of the trap and take it away?
He just take it out of the trap and go away with it and hide it.
And bury it in the snow?
Yeah, bury it in the snow. He never go under a windfall with it, or he never go into a hole or anything like that with the. He's got to bury it in the snow.
Hmm.
We don't know what it is for. That's the reason, as soon as we know there's a wolverine on our trapping area where we're trapping for marten, we got to get rid of the wolverine. And at them times, wolverine fur was very, very poor, very cheap. Because they say they don't use it for nothing but the rocks. But later on, that they find out that was a good parquet trimmers. Because when the frost get on, you hit it and the frost falls right off, it don't ice up. So, Wolverine went high, it's pretty high price. But it's a funny thing, since the Wolverine price went sky high, it's pretty hard to kill a Wolverine. I don't know why. And when we set trap, we don't touch the trap with bare hand. In a cold weather, if you catch a trap with your hand with the trap without mitts or something like that, you leave your scent right on the trap and it freeze on. And it'll be all winter, you'll never get that scent out of the trap.
I heard sometimes they boil the traps, does that do it?
Yeah.
But that, and you got it in you, yeah.
And the wolves, it's a great one for that. No matter where you set your trap, they know where it is. Their nose is pretty sensitive. They know there's humans being smell in there. So, some people, they take a spruce boughs and put it in the water and boil that up. And then you put on a mittens. Put on a mittens, you don't try to touch the mitts, handle the mitts too much to keep the scent off. That is the part, the front side of it where you catch the traps. You take the traps and dip it into this boiling water with the spruce needles and then hang it up. That killed the scent of everything. Your human being scent and all that sort of stuff. And you hang the traps away from the camp where there's no smoke, because they can tell the smoke goes into it, well, it stay on it. So when you're going to set a trap for a wolf rings or wolf, you use the canvas gloves or you use the gloves that you don't handle around much. Don't touch the traps with bare-handed, without mitts, because the scent will never leave the trap until you boil it again. So that's how much I know about it. But the beaver trap, you don't have to be that fussy about it. Because every trap you set for beaver, it's set under the water about 6 inches of deep water on top of it. You don't have much trouble with the beaver trap in the beaver pond, because the beaver pond don't go up and down in the springtime. It stays in one level. But the river, one night sometimes, it might jump a foot, or another time it'll drop a foot. And then your trap is up in the open air. Another time it'll be 1 foot underwater, is too deep. For that reason, in a river we always set a trap in a bank. So if the water go down and leave the trap in the air, the beaver have to climb the hill, the bank, to get to the bait. By climbing that way, sometimes it gets into the trap and it jumps back over and it drowns himself. And we don't lose that.
You mentioned baits. Did you use baits much?
Yes. All we use, it's a popple. We cut the popple and we use that for bait.
Nice green popple.
Green popple. And we don't touch that popple with a bare hand, we use mitts. Drive it into the ground. And we don't set them purple red in the middle of the trap house. If there's a, and the trap, we don't set it right in the middle of the trap house. We set it to one side, either the left side or the right side. And you guarantee you're going to catch them either on the left side or on the right paw, front paw. And at the same time, if you set your trap on the right side, and you have to put your bait on the right side too, because that's how we set traps for the beaver.
Did you ever use any mix up any things for baits, like using beaver caster? Or?
Yes, beaver caster and beaver gums together. Mm-hmm. We used that.
Would you just put that right on the trap, or?
No. You put it on a bait, whatever you use for bait. If not, you pile a little mud up and put that beaver caster in the grass and leave it on top of the mud. But that's what they do. The beaver bring a mud up on a bank and then they sit on it and they get the caster all over it. Another one comes around, they do the same on that area, and that's how we set traps in the same kind of places.
How did you used to catch wolves? You were saying there was a problem that you had to have a clean trap to start with. What sort of sets would you make for wolves?
If we get any, we leave any bait for wolves, we leave it in a water is thick brush. We take a wire or something and tie it down. And then we keep an eye on that, and if the wolves come around, they don't come out, they go in through the bush. Each one of the wolves got its own trail. And they step from tracks to tracks all the time. So when we set a trap there, we used the mitts on our hand and we set the trap. Then we push about 2 feet away from the tracks, we push the traps under the snow until we come to the tracks where the track is, put it right in there. And we sprinkle the pan up with little snow on it so it won't show. And the bear and the wolf don't take notice of it, and that's how we catch them.
And sometimes they put a stick in the snow and
wolves. No, it's just the tracks. They got a track. They get a each one of the wolves get their own trails.
Oh, I see. So if you're going into an area and you see there's wolves in there and you think they're going to bother you, you can pretty well pick the wolf off.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that should do it. I see we're just about out of tape and we're just about out of time. So I guess we'll stop there.